We are in the month of generosity. We're practicing with the first paramis of generosity. Last couple of weeks, we talked about the essence of that nature of generosity. This idea of letting go, that generosity itself is not just about giving, but it's the kind of the meat of the practice, the whole fundamental aspect that we are practicing to let go of this grasping, clinging nature that's so thick within us. Ajahn Chah said one time that the Buddha told us the way things are. Buddha told us to see the way things are and let go of our clinging to them. So take this feeling of letting go as your refuge. The whole point of practicing in generosity is to get to know, both internally and externally, this feeling of letting go. What does that feel like? How can we tell that we've let something go, or that we're holding on to something, that we're clinging versus letting it go? So this next 2 weeks, we're going to talk about this actual practice. What does the practice of generosity look like? See if we can maybe even break down the concept of generosity even further than just the idea of letting go. What would letting go actually look like if we were to practice with it? So someone asked me last week, it seems that, you know, like, I guess we're talking mostly about giving, and what is it like if you are receiving? So I contemplated on this, and I read, and I got to tell you, I just don't think there's any difference between the two. I don't think there's any difference between giving and receiving. It's one and the same act. I read this article by Tanisaro Bhikkhu, and he said that the Buddha had two main principles around generosity. That gifts are to be given freely, and that the gifts that are given continue to bear some fruit towards liberation. That's it. That the gifts are given freely, and that the gifts that are given continue to bear some fruit of liberation. He said that this idea, this what I would call Buddha's generosity, Buddha's idea of giving, his type of giving, would flourish primarily in environments where the environment is untainted. The gifts themselves are untainted by greed, hatred, and delusion. That's basically our giving is the act, the practice is in the act of giving and receiving. So for the person, if we just practice, if we just look at this receiving aspect instead of the giving aspect, then the person that would be receiving would not put any pressure on the person doing the giving to give them something. There wouldn't be a sense of coercion or, demanding of a gift. Or the gift itself would not be freely offered. So this would be this practice that the receiving would happen without expectation of getting more or something better than whatever was offered. But that is the same thing for the giver, that the giver would actually be giving without some expectation that they would get some reward because they gave in the first place. So it doesn't really matter whether you are on the receiving end or you are on the giving end. The idea is that that gift that is exchanged in that energy is done so freely. And then, the second aspect, if you were trying to create an environment that was untainted by greed, hatred, or delusion, the second aspect or atmosphere is the second thing you do is you create this atmosphere of trust. A trust out of the need that the gift or the person doing the receiving actually needs this gift, and that they would use this gift in a respectful way. Somebody gave you something that you actually needed, and you're going to use it in a respectful way. So there, in a way, what Thanissaro Bhikkhu said was that it's kind of a mutual respect between the fact that the giver is giving this gift to you, that you would treat it with care, and that the person who's actually receiving the gift creates, well, the donor creates for the person receiving a gift, that I'm offering this gift to you in kind of a respectful way. So a way to think about it is, from the perspective of teaching the Dhamma, if I thought you were giving me dana because you owed it to me, because there was some obligation that you had to give it to me, you had to give it to me, based on whether or not the talk was good enough or not, it would be kind of difficult to sit up here and figure out a way to talk in such a way that, you know, am I going to give a good talk or a bad talk? It creates this environment that is not trustworthy. At the same time, if I put pressure on people to give me a certain amount of dana in order for me to be happy, am I going to show up or not, depending on how much you give me, it's the same kind of mistrust. There's a bit of, it's not working here. But if we create an environment where we are all giving freely, so there's a sense that whatever gift is offered from the free will of the person doing the giving, and that whatever gift is offered is then used to further the Dhamma, then something else happens between us. And that's what I want to talk about tonight. Something else happens when we give freely and in an atmosphere between mutual respect and trust. And that is Buddha's generosity, and that's, well, I would call it Buddha's generosity. And that's what I want to talk about tonight, because there's something that happens when all of that shows up. So the first thing I want to kind of point towards is that this act of generosity, this practice, if we were to practice in this generosity, what we're practicing is really abundance. We're practicing this idea that there is enough. Because the only time we even think about giving something, the only time we'd even consider letting something go, is we have to think there's enough. Or we're going to kind of hold it a bit. Wait a minute before I actually give something out. So there has to be a sense that there's enough. We're practicing, actually, we're not practicing the generosity, we're practicing the idea of abundance. And that practicing the idea of abundance is what creates our capacity to let go. But in reality, life, the mind thinks everything is scarce. The mind thinks that there's not enough. We need to wait a minute before we give it out, because we're not sure that there'll be enough. But reality of the way life is, there's always abundance. There's always enough. Even in our most cruel ways of being with the earth and land, there's always enough. We don't always see that in the way that we relate to land. But I remember one time some friends of mine, we go hiking all the time, and if you go hiking up in the National Forest, they have, you can do this little, they do a little evening talk on some foresty kind of thing. And so we went to this evening talk with this ranger, and she decided to do her talk on climate change. That's what she called it. So the minute she said climate change, there's like this, oh, in the room, and everyone's all kind of there's this disgruntled, do I stay? I thought we were going to talk about the little chipmunks or something like that. And so she said, I'm not going to talk about global warming. I'm going to talk about climate change. And so she started talking about how the climate was changing. For whatever reason you want to call it, the climate was clearly changing. It is getting hotter and hotter and hotter on this earth. But her talk was so different than I had ever heard anyone talk about climate change ever. Because she didn't approach it from the point of, we got to fix this problem we're doing. What she approached it from was how the earth takes care of itself, no matter what happens to it. It takes care of itself. It cares for itself in different ways. It readjusts itself to make sure that it can care for itself. And at the end of this talk, she said, it's unlikely that humans will be able to remain on this planet at the rate we're going. But the earth will take care of itself. It will make adjustments. It will add more a little here and take away a little there, but it has a sense of abundance and not the sense of scarcity. The scarcity comes from this grasping greed in the mind. It is a human tendency. It's there in us when we're born. It underlines all of our actions, and it's there. So we practice to see that tendency towards greed and grasping in the mind. We practice to see that. And when we can see it, when we can see that grasping and scarcity, we can let go. We can experience this much greater abundance that's in the world. Sharon Salzberg said that the movement of the heart as we practice generosity in the outer world mirrors the movement of the heart when we let go of conditioned views about ourselves on our inner journey. Letting go creates a joyful sense of space in our mind. So even though we are doing all this practicing towards letting go of this grasping mind, one way to do that comes out of a practice of abundance, looking for this idea that there's more available than the mind thinks there is. And what would abundance look like? One thing you could think of is that there will always be people in need. Well, think about that. There will always be people in need, people who have less than and need our help. So one way you could think of that is, oh, isn't there a way that we could get rid of people not get rid of, but stop or end this impoverished nature of people or this problems that people have? Isn't there a way that idealistically we could be in a world where nobody needed any help? But if nobody needed any help, none of us could step into abundance because we would never be able to give to anyone. There is a need to give to people and a need for people to need that help, because that moves into the second aspect of letting go. We have three gifts that we actually give out. One is the gift of material objects. So this idea that people need and we give, or we need and someone gives to us, that Dana, if you will, is what it's called, this gift of material objects. Dana, this giving and receiving energy, is actually the practice of gratitude and mudita. We need this. We need this gratitude and mudita. Buddha said there are two people that are hard to find in the world. Which two? The one who is first to do a kindness, and the one who is grateful and thankful for the kindness done. It's hard to find these people. Bhikkhu Bodhi did this article about this, a little snippet about it, and was saying that it's not that he's saying that it is hard to find these two people in the world because the world is so cruel and mean that barely there's any kindness. What he's saying is, it's hard to find two people who know that's what's happening, who is aware that there is the act of kindness in the world and a grateful, and someone that is grateful for the kindness done. Mostly it happens all the time, but we just don't have the benefit of the awareness of gratitude and mudita. So like today's society, we give a lot. I mean, especially in this country, we give a lot to nonprofits. We give a lot of money and time and treasure to all kinds of things that are very, very important to us. Many of the small nonprofit businesses run solely off of someone's giving and generosity, even like Sims. So there's all this giving that goes on in the world. But some of this becomes like getting the best of the bargain, whether or not we're getting a good deal. How much is, there's all this concern about whether you're trying to make money off of it, whether it's going good, whether I'm giving to this organization or that organization. And this giving can get caught into a much more secular way of looking at it. So there's giving going on, but no one's really paying attention to this act of kindness and having gratitude for it. So if we want to create an environment that's not tainted by this greed, hatred, and delusion, an environment that's steeped in generosity, then when you receive, you'll need a gracious heart. You'll need to recognize that someone has given to you. So in the same article, it was pointed out that the way you know, or the way you practice generating generosity, because generosity is not easy. I mean, not generosity, but gratitude. It's not easy. I didn't realize it was not easy. But I remember having a huge argument with my niece when she was 17. And I made some statement like, "You are just not grateful for nothing you get. You just think you get anything and everything." And she didn't understand. She just kind of blew off this attitude that you'd have to be grateful. You know, if somebody don't want to give her something, then just don't give it to me. But this whole idea of gratitude was, she just thought that's something from church, but you know, it's not really a big deal whether you're grateful or not. Fast forward a couple of years, couple of kids. And we're sitting at Thanksgiving, and her and her husband went through this really, really, really difficult time. She was going to go to University of Las Vegas for a master's program. And when she got down there and she had her school, everything was set up, the school canceled the program she was in. And she got stuck down there in Las Vegas, and she didn't have any money, and nothing is working the way they planned it to work, and she's just struggling. And her mother and I used to send her money. Her and her husband, we'd send money, we'd send little care packages. And so eventually she moved back home. Thanksgiving comes around. We're sitting around the table. And she's talking about gratitude in a way that she had never talked about it before. Because now she has a pure understanding of gratitude, where that comes from. And this is what I think I noticed in her conversation. This is why. Because you have to actually have benefited from someone else's action. This is what you need for gratitude as you're practicing this. You have to have actually benefited from someone's actions. Someone did something and you know you got the benefit of that. The second thing is you have to trust the intentions or the motivation behind what that person did. So it's not that someone just did something for you. You have to know that they did something in this much more wholesome intention that went behind it. And then the third thing is you have to have a sense that the person went out of their way to do something for you, either because they didn't have to or because they made a special effort to do this for you. When you can sense that someone goes out of their way, that they have this wholesome intention behind helping you, and they do something that you benefit from it, then you can find gratitude. When you begin to contemplate that, I mean, why else would we not have, why could we not have gratitude just by living in this place? Just by sitting here on Tuesday night, there's so much gratitude, especially for those of us who know what it was like before we got our own place. So there's a sense of knowing that someone did something for us, good intention, and they went out of their way to help us. We benefit from that. That's where that gratitude comes from. So when you contemplate on that and you recognize that, that is hard to find, that people will actually connect to that part. Likewise, though, the one who actually is giving, that's the person who does the receiving. The one who's giving cannot come out of pressure. Or you deny this exchange to be steeped in mudita. So mudita is a brahmavihara, it's a heart practice. It's a heart energy. And we need mudita in order to get up every day and find joy, because there's joy all around us. It may not be in your particular condition right now. So circumstances could have shown up in your life and it's kind of ugly right now. But mudita is what helps us stay connected to a much more deeper much more interconnected universal sense of joy that's all around us, even if it's not directly in our conditioning. So when somebody gives out of some sense of freedom, just gives out of this inspiration in their heart, and then they watch you have a sense of joy around what they have given, they then get to experience that mudita. And then you, because of the mudita in the person who's doing the giving, get to also experience mudita in the joy from the person who does the giving. Do you see what's happening here? There's all this back and forth that's going on in this giving that's much deeper and much more important to us than whether or not you put something in the dana basket. Because if we don't practice intentionally watching this giving back and forth, we don't get to connect with that mudita. We don't get to sense into that heart joy that we need as a human being, because life is tough. It is hard. The mind is always grasping towards scarcity. So, see if I can find my little Shanti Deva. He says, when happiness is equally dear to others and myself, then what is so special about me that I strive after happiness for myself alone? When happiness is equally dear to others and myself, then what is so special about me that I strive after happiness for myself alone? When fear and suffering are equally abhorrent to others and myself, then what is so special about me that I protect myself but not others? But when you begin to see that our happiness, our joy, our sense of abundance is tied into the energetic connection of other people, that we actually need other people to need us so that we can give, that act of us giving and their needing is what keeps us up every day, happy and alert and practicing. It's what inspires us to want to practice. Which leads to this second gift, this gift of fearlessness. It's the kaja level of practice. And I would say that kaja is the practice of non-harm. This, when we practice non-harm, we're actually practicing generosity. It's how we learn to trust our ability to actually let go of stuff. Let go, that we won't fall. We won't be destroyed just because we begin to let go. If you think about it, we are surrounded by fear. We are surrounded by the idea that some terrible thing is out there. I mean, there probably was a time when we lived in much smaller communities and we didn't have the level of communication the way we have it now. And so basically your fear level is based on how secure your little small community feels. And if your little small community feels pretty safe, you feel pretty safe. But now, if we find out about something in Japan, we're just as scared as if it was happening here. It's not just Japan. If something happens in South America, we're scared. If something happens in Europe, we're scared. Something happens in New York, Alaska, Tacoma. We know about things that happen down the street. I mean, look at how much fear is all around us. And so the idea that we would actually practice fearlessness might seem a little counterintuitive. Of course, all Buddhist practice is a little counterintuitive. But it's the nature of this practice. We really are practicing fearlessness. We're practicing fearlessness because there's something in fearlessness that is far more powerful than fear. And that practicing of fearlessness is in the practice of non-harm. We tell people, we send this message out in the world, you have nothing to fear from me. It's not that we don't harm anyone. It's just that we practice this refraining from harming people, harming things. It's how we create this environment that isn't tainted by greed, hatred, and delusion, because you don't have to fear me in my relationship with you. Basically, what it is, when you start reading deeper into the text and you get kind of look into this question of what fearlessness is, I don't get the sense that it's I'm not afraid. We think of fearlessness as a sense of I'm not afraid. But that would somehow make fear a bad thing, when fear is just the nature of being human. It's an emotion that arises. So we're always going to have fear. So this fearlessness is something other than not afraid. It's actually more connected to blamelessness. It's a sense that you can hold your head up. You can you can not harm people, not because you're not afraid of them or not afraid in a situation, but because you are blameless in your actions. That you take care for how you act. You hold yourself accountable for your behaviors, your words, and your deeds. So, our ability to work hard, be successful, achieve whatever we want to achieve, isn't going to come out of some kind of weaker sense of me because I'm, you know, not going to, nobody's going to have to worry about me harming them. I could just imagine when I was a prosecutor, the idea that I wouldn't harm someone, that would be kind of difficult. Because, you know, trials can get a little rough. And there's a little bit of harm going back and forth. There's a bit of, you know, fighting, competition that goes on in trials. And you are trying to win. But think about it, you know, I could win in some shady kind of coercive, underhanded way. Or I could have this courage to just do what I think is the right thing to do and not get trapped in the results having to be a certain way. So I'm doing the right thing with wholesome energy, even though there's competition there, and there's a little bit of, you know, fighting back and forth. There's a blamelessness about that. That's what we're looking for. This fearlessness is blamelessness. That we're going through the world without this underhanded, much more destructive way of relating. Joseph Goldstein, I have a quote from him. He says, "The commitment to morality or non-harming is a source of tremendous strength because it frees the mind from the remorse of having done unwholesome actions. Freedom from remorse leads to happiness. Happiness leads to concentration. Concentration brings wisdom, and wisdom is the source of peace and freedom in our lives." So when we are practicing generosity by giving the gift of fearlessness, we are actually practicing living a more blameless life. We're practicing this act of non-harm. The final act, the final gift that we give in this practice of generosity is the gift of Dhamma. And this gift of Dhamma, I think that is the level of upadhi. It's the highest level. And I would say that upadhi is the practice of kindness. It's kind of strange, though, because the more I practice, the longer I have been practicing, the less I think this is about meditation, and the more I think this is about kindness. No, I call it kindness. I mean, some people call it love, but I just can't seem to connect with that word. But the idea of kindness is so big to me. It is almost impossible for us to just be kind. But that's what this is about. This is practicing kindness, and there's nothing outside of that in this world of practicing the Dhamma. You can't experience letting go without kindness. There has to be a bit of softening in your mind in order for us to let go. Some of the most entrenched anger and emotional, just gunk, glued together in my mind. I had to be kind to it. I had to be nice, soft, because as I was trying to fight that gunk to get it to go away, it would not move. But then when I was kind, when I was soft to it, when I stopped pushing against it and kind of let it be in this softer way. I can't remember the teacher that said, basically, it could have even been Rodney, said, basically you have to be resolved that this is it. This is where I'm going to be from now on. And as soon as I would be resolved, okay, I could accept this as part of my life. Psh, gone. This upadhi level of generosity seems to me that it's actually going beyond this idea of just giving and receiving. I'll tell you what I mean. So as we sit here, who's giving and who's receiving? Right? Might seem, oh, Tori is giving a talk. We are receiving it. But it's not really a giving of a talk if you don't actually practice with it. So you're giving this sincere practice and I then receive it. Rodney, a lot of what you hear in my teaching came from Rodney. Rodney was my teacher. Was I giving? He's giving, I'm receiving. But then Rodney got his teaching from Joseph and from his other teachers. They got their Dhamma from the teachers before them. So at some point, they have to try to figure out, is it really a giving and receiving going on here? Is there really this just a giving, I'm giving you something and you receive something? Or is there something on a much higher level? And I think that higher level is kindness. It's how we create an environment that is not tainted by greed, hatred, and delusion. So we do this by we practice the Dhamma, we're doing what we can to liberate the mind, we look for our defilements, our habits of minds, our conditionings, we work with this unhooking of attachments and anger and blindness, the blinders that we can't see. Try to practice so we can see through whatever distortions are showing up in the mind. We're doing all this work, but all of it is based and steeped in kindness. Jack Kornfield said that nirvana manifests as ease, as love, as connectedness, as generosity, as clarity, as unshakable freedom. This isn't watering down nirvana. This is the reality of liberation, that we can experience something in a moment, and sometimes in transformative ways that change our entire life. It is the reality of liberation. That's what generosity is. This kindness that we connect to. It is the reality in that moment that you can experience liberation in this exchange, giving and receiving. So that may not seem like very much just sitting here, listening to a talk on generosity. But this kindness I speak of is incredibly powerful, and I know some of you know that. Because if anybody was at a march over the weekend, you know what I'm talking about. There was this incredible kindness all around us. You know that I went to Washington, D.C., and I was on a train that was squished tight, corner to corner, full of people. But everyone was laughing and joking, and of course, women, we were screaming. But there was no tension anywhere. And I can remember, because by the time we got on the train, it was already stuffed. We had to stuff ourselves on. But people were like pulling us on, squishing us in even deeper. And I can remember the train, in some aspect, I felt myself falling. So when I felt myself falling, there's an immediate sense of, oh, I'm going to fall into you. I don't know you. I got to stand up straight. And this woman said, oh, don't even worry about it. We'll catch you. She doesn't know me. We didn't have any, there's no tension, no anger. How come that is? When I think about it, the only thing I can remember about the entire weekend was the kindness. It was thick. It was so awesome. And it felt so powerful. We didn't actually do anything. For those of you that were at the march, you know that we didn't actually do anything. But I will never forget that sense of power that came with just being with a just tremendous amount of people. And the only interaction I had with anyone was in kindness. So we were way up towards the stage part. And I remembered that when they start marching, they're going to turn around and we're going to be at the end of the march. So my sister-in-law went with me, and her sister is afraid of crowds. And she's getting a little antsy, and I just began to think we should move through. So we are now moving against the grain of thousands of people. They're all coming this way, and we're going this way. It's packed full of people. In fact, there were some people that were having panic attacks because it was so many people. And they have to try to get out. So you are, imagine that there are like thousands of people from this spot, and you are trying to get over to Airport Way. But there are like thousands and thousands and thousands of people. They are all coming this way. You want to go that way. It takes an act of kindness to basically move out of the way. You don't really have to. It's understandable. There's too many people. But people would see someone panicking and they would make a way. They would figure out a way to open a path to help this person through. That's it. It's all just kindness. I think that's what the ultimate gift is. Ajahn Chah says the greatest gift you could give to the world is to make your mind still. And I think that stillness is kindness. So if we're going to practice, you know, in this world that we live in, the most powerful thing we can do is to begin to practice kindness. To begin to see that kindness we experienced at the march, and that kindness that you hear in all the posts and all the comments that people make about the march, if you didn't even go, you're like, everything you hear comes from this unbelievable, I can't believe there were so many people and there was so much kindness. That kindness is really all that's important. I think that's the ultimate level of generosity, is kindness. My favorite, I like to end with this quote from one of my favorite teachers, is Shantideva. And he said, "Never take lightly a tiny drop of water. In time, even the tiniest drop of water will fill an ocean." So in the midst of all of this fear that's all around us, worry, uncertainty, all of that sense of darkness and I don't know, we do one thing: kindness. Kindness, 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 kindness. We practice a sense of abundance in a world that's trapped in scarcity. We practice giving and receiving so that we can experience the joy of gratitude and mudita, and we can give the joy of gratitude and mudita. And we practice kindness. So let's sit for a few minutes here. Okay, see if there's any questions. Or comments. Doesn't have to be a question all the time. Sometimes we just have something we have to say. Yes. So the question is, she has some friends that practice with gratitude around painful things, and she's wondering those three things around how to have a grateful mind, how that would work with painful things. And so I guess I'm not sure, to tell you the truth. There seems to be a difference with Buddha between gratitude and appreciation. So even though in English we kind of take the words and mix them together, the energy is a little different. The energy of appreciation is almost like having a sense of care for something. The example that's always used is this, the Buddha and some monks needed to get across a river, and they used a raft to, they built a raft together to get across the river, this waterway, and at the end, they left the raft there. That there, you appreciate that the raft is what got you to the other side of the shore. But that is not the same as gratitude. So it could be, it sounds like that there's a sense of appreciation for going through some difficult time. But gratitude is really more reserved for the recognition that someone else has given you something. And that intention behind their behavior is a wholesome quality, and that they really didn't have to do it. That there's a sense that someone has actually given me something that, or done some act that supports me. So if I were to go out here on a limb, go way out there, and I thought to myself, I came from a pretty rough family, pretty abusive in a lot of respects. And some of my mother's behavior, I would say, is lining up with some abuse. But I could see where the difficulty that came out of that I experienced, I could see that she had a wholesome intention to do right by me, even though, in retrospect, she could have taken some parenting classes that might have helped. Might not have made it quite so bad. But I could see that even in my own practice, there's a sense of gratitude for the effort that she made to try her best to do what she thought was a good thing, even though I have a lot of difficulties in life because of that. Do you see? So there would be a sense that I could see that there was a wholesome intention in her actions, even though they weren't always necessarily the best. So I'm not sure if that's the way they look at it or they hold it that way. But that would be what I would think would be the distinction between appreciation and gratitude. Anyone else? So the question is, how can there be a wholesome intention with unwise action? And I guess it depends on, you go down a slippery slope here, right? Because I think from my mother's point of view, her actions were not unwise. Her actions, from her perspective at the time, were skillful. She was a good mama. I'm not saying it was so good, and even that is only looking back and judging it based on the way, the difficulties I have in my life now, is what I'm saying. So I can't look at my difficulties now and say, your actions were bad back then, is what I'm saying. So instead of trying to negotiate my way around her intentions, I can have a sense of gratitude for all the effort she did to try to make life better for her children. Because without a doubt, I believe that's what she tried to do. But her sense of having to control everything that we did made things a little bit more difficult for us when we got older. Can you see? So it's like I can have a good intention, but it doesn't mean that there's not going to be some harm that comes as a result of that. My capacity to have gratitude for that comes because I recognize there was a good intention. I benefited from her actions, and I forgot the third one. Benefited? There was a good intention. Can't remember. Anyway. Oh, yes. And that they took some, that I can see that she did a lot to make things happen for us in a good way. I can see how much she tried to do the best she could. You know, I can, there's without a doubt, I mean, my mother would make us dresses and put like 36 buttons on it, you know, because she thought it was cute that there were so many buttons all the way down. So she would hand make her sew the buttons on and sew the little buttonholes. I mean, she went out of her way to do these great things for us. But then if you were in your little dress that was so cute, if you got any dirt on it, if you happen to be a tomboy like some of us are, just wasn't the same to her. She thought if she made these little dresses that then you would sit quietly. And I was a little rough around the edges. So this concept of sitting quietly didn't work. So we were always tussling over how to be. But there's no doubt that she did not have this wholesome intention to try to do the right thing. Do you see? That's for my gratitude. It's not about how I hold this is my practice, my gratitude, my opportunity to be free and liberated from that difficulty. Or I could hold it in a lot of aversion and anger. It's not going to do anything to her one way or the other. It really has to do with how I'm going to hold it. Do you see the difference? Okay. Oh, yeah. Go ahead. Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think for a lot of people, that's not their perspective, the sound that they're coming from. So, what could you speak about fake until you make it? Around that.
Yeah. I guess all of these concepts. So the I don't know if you guys heard the question, but the question is, I'm talking about abundance, and a lot of people don't have a sense that there's abundance everywhere. So how do you fake it until you make it kind of thing? But everything about the Dhamma is counterintuitive. Everything about what we think of in practice. I mean, the idea of stilling the mind is counterintuitive when you sit there and try to put your attention on the breath. It's the last place the mind wants to go to. But we do it, right? Is it faking it when we keep coming back to the breath? I don't know if that's a fake. That's just to keep coming back, and sometimes we get lost. So the idea isn't that you have to have a sense of abundance. But we are practicing towards an understanding of an abundance, an awareness of abundance. So in Dhamma, there's no difference between the actual experience of abundance and being aware that you don't experience abundance. One way of learning to experience abundance is to notice when you're caught in scarcity. Notice when you don't experience abundance. Because the only way for us to think, oh, well, I don't have a sense of abundance, then you must know what abundance is. You know when it's there, and you know when it's not there. So your practice is just noticing when it's there, noticing when it's not there. But I can't think of any way in practice where we are going to know something for what it is. Because everything in Dhamma is counterintuitive. And everything about it, we have to step into it with trust and faith. Look for it until we find it. That is the point of practicing with abundance, is to look for it. Yes, ma'am. Well, I mean, if you're meaning being present, meaning being accepting with whatever it is, but you can notice if there's a constricted mind, scarcity, not enough, there's a tightness there, and you can notice when there's an open heart, a sense of more capacity, abundance. Not next week we're going to talk about some ways that we could actually practice with this The impact of it is what we're going to talk about next week.
It knows without
identifying. Yes. That there's no you that's either scarce or abundant, but just beginning to notice what it feels like to have an open heart and what it feels like to have a constricted heart. Just notice that. It doesn't even matter whether or not your heart is always constricted. If you keep noticing that it's constricted, eventually something is going to happen. The mind will actually notice the pain it's causing itself and let go. In some respects, we think we have to let go, but that's why we practice with generosity, because it's in the practice of generosity that the mind learns to let go on its own, not that I have to force myself to let go. I just have to watch this internal movement and flow. So we probably should end there. Okay, thank you.